I'm Eddie G. I'm an addict. I asked God today to channel a message through me that will help somebody, but now I want to ask God to remove me from me, to divorce me from me, so that He may work through me. Give me just a moment, please. I'm supposed to tell you today, in a general way, what that it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'm going to qualify myself by telling you a few instances of my life, and I'm going to try not to stay real long in that, because it's no sense in me telling you all my war stories. I think that everybody here has war stories of their own, or we wouldn't be here. I was raised here in Birmingham, and I was raised by really good parents. I can't say that my mom and dad has any bearing on what that happened to me, other than trying to be good parents, and one part of enabling, and they just thought they were doing the best that they could do for me. But my mom and dad, they weren't alcoholics. They liked to drink and have a good time. They were normal drinkers. They would drink on the weekend. My brothers, I'm sort of old, and back then families would get together. My dad, he played the guitar, and my mother sang, and my brothers played guitars and uncles, and we'd get together and they'd play guitars and sing, and they drank their beer. And, you know, Monday morning my dad was going to work. I can honestly say that I've never seen my dad falling down drunk or throwing up or anything like that, you know. I might have seen my mother get sick once that I can remember. It just, you know, they drank and had a good time and was able to continue with life. In my situation, though, that wasn't quite the case. They were good parents. I went to church when I was a kid. I got saved. I got baptized. I loved going to church. You know, I had a good heart. God was in my life. And, you know, I didn't know it until I got to this program about wanting to fit in and things of that nature. But my mom and dad, we moved around a lot. I've probably been to every school in Jefferson County. My mother, God rest her soul, we would move to a neighborhood, and it wouldn't be 2 or 3 months, and she'd be riding through another neighborhood and see a house that she liked better, and we were moving. And as a result of that, you know, kids are sort of mean. And when a new kid comes to school, well, he ain't got no friends. And usually the ones that you end up being friends with is the 2 or 3 kids on the playground that comes over and wants to play with you, because they're the kids that are the outcasts from all the cool kids anyway. You know, I don't know if you've ever experienced that, but now that I've been in this program and able to look back on my life, I see that trend starting, that I wanted to fit in. And I was in the Boy Scouts the first time I ever got drunk. I was in the Boy Scouts, and I was 11 years old, and we went to Eglin Air Force Base, and to see the Thunderbirds fly, and they had these beer machines, like Coke machines, in every barracks. And I don't think that they had planned on 11-year-old kids coming down and staying in those barracks, because we hit that beer machine real heavy. And ended up having to have the MPs to bring us back to our barracks. We got lost on the base. I pissed all over myself and woke up the next morning with a bad headache, and I was never going to do that again. But it ended up that this wasn't the case. The first time I ever got high was with a friend. My first concert was Billy Joel at Boutwell Auditorium, and I was 11 years old. During that same period of time is when things started happening for me, and his sister smoked a joint with us. Now, when I smoked that joint, I was sure I was going to do that again. I really enjoyed that high. You know, I was scared of doctors, didn't like shots when I was a kid, all these things, you know. So, of course, I was never going to shoot dope. That didn't end up being the case. You know, but there's a lot of things that were yets for me, you know. And that's the reason when I tell you my story, I hope you look for the similarities, not the differences. Because when I was out there getting high, you know, I always seen differences in other addicts. Like when I started doing crystal meth and when I started doing cocaine even, a lot of people put coke on their gums, and you know, a lot of the people that I got high with or would buy dope and stuff, they would come and they'd have teeth falling out, you know? And I'd go, man, I'm never going to be like that. Well, you know what? That was a yet. I'm right now in case of getting teeth pulled and getting dentures, you know? That was just a yet. When I was 13, I was going to school in Gresham Junior High School. That same friend smoked that joint with me. We were in PE. And he had this little piece of cardboard, and he goes, hey man, come on Eddie, try this, man. And I'm like looking at it, and it's a piece of cardboard, y'all, with a red, white, and blue man on it shooting a peace sign. I'm like, what's that going to do, you know? So he told me to chew it up, so I took it and chewed it up. He goes, hey, where's the rest of that? I went, rest of it? You told me to chew it up. It was a four-way hit of Mr. Natural. Our next class, the best I remember was a history class, and the teacher of it was this great old big lady. And all I know is, all I can remember about all this was that I'm sitting there, and she's writing on the blackboard, and the next thing I know, hair starts growing out of her body all over. And she turned into a full-grown ape writing on the blackboard. And I started laughing. I mean, if you've ever done acid, you know what I'm talking about. I started laughing, and I couldn't stop laughing. And my friends was in the class, the next class down the hall, and they heard me laughing. So you know what happened to them. They started laughing. They're escorting us all three to the principal's office. We can't quit laughing. I get suspended for 3 days, and my mother comes and picks me up. And I'm sitting in the back seat, because, you know, I didn't want her to know nothing. I'm sitting in the back seat, and I've got my shit together, you know, because of the fear. And we're driving home, and she looks back, and she goes, what happened to you, son? Did you get your tickle box turned over? I lost it again, man. Yeah. Oh, man. But, you know, I can tell you this about my using. From the time that between 11 and 13 years old, I realized that whatever school that I ended up going to, that there was people there, and this was in the 70s, that liked to get high. And everybody was smoking pot. And if you were cool, you were cool. And you fit in wherever you went. And I had long blonde hair down my back, and I fit in everywhere I went. Because there was always somebody wanting to get high, you know. And at a young age, I had a guy that started fronting me weed. And I started selling lids back then, four-finger lids for $15. And they gave me a deal on them, so I got free weed. And back then, foosball was real popular. And I'd walk in a foosball hall, and I had all kinds of friends. And people, they were glad to see me. They had been waiting to see me, you know. And I found a new way to live at that point. And I don't have to tell you about my cocaine use. I'm here for CA, and I moved to California in 1980. And I don't have to tell you about cocaine in California in 1980 because they later wrote a movie about it called Blow. Cocaine was everywhere, y'all. I mean, I'm telling you, we used to sit in the bars and do lines of cocaine in the bar off the table. It was just acceptable. I mean, everybody was getting high out there. And, you know, me, and at that time I met a girl in Mobile. I got into a traveling sales job at a young age. I left here at about 16. I was about to turn 17. And a friend of mine that I'd met here was from Cincinnati, Ohio. And he had a brother that had was a manager in a traveling sales company. And the guy that he worked for liked to travel to the nicest places at the nicest times of the year. So what he did is he had this sales team. We were like a little family, and we sold knife sets all over the United States. And I went to work in Chicago, Illinois, and my parents were scared to death me going to a big city like that, being just a little Alabama boy. And I got up there, and we were supposed to sell 7 sets of knives a day. And y'all, I was the worst salesman in the world. I sold 0 to 1 on a good day, you know. They were fixing to leave and go to Hawaii. And when they would leave Chicago, when it would start getting cold, we would fly to Hawaii and work over there during the summer. Well, man, I come from a poor family. And my family, the only people that had ever been to Hawaii, and my whole family was an aunt and an uncle, and he was a state park ranger for the state of Alabama, and she was a x-ray technician. And that meant a lot to me to get to go. And the owner came to me and he said, look, Eddie, he says, you know, we all like you, like for you to be able to go. And I love this job because when I got to Chicago, this guy, he had two jet boats down on the chain of lakes up by Waukegan, Illinois. It's called the Fox River there, and it's a chain of lakes. And we had jet boats. And on these lakes, there's bars everywhere. Well, you see, because I was hanging out with him, I got to go in all the bars and drink. We drive the boats from bar to bar, man. I had a ride, man. I was living like the life, you know. And so he told me I had to start writing my sales pitch, and he gave me these books to read. And I tell you this part of my story because I think it's real important about that ego and that never lose attitude and that I could beat anything. But he gave me a book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, and I read it like 13 times. I also ended up reading books by Zig Ziglar and W. Clement Stone and all these books that developed this in me. When I got to Hawaii, I ended up getting to go. I got my sales up. When I got to Hawaii, I ended up breaking the company record over there. I ended up being a crew manager at like 18 years old. I had a crew car and I got to drive around, you know. And I tell you, my second trip to Hawaii, I ended up leaving the island because me and my best friend, Rick Morlock, at that time, was the guy that got me the job. We had found some mushroom tea one day, and on the island, after you've been there a while, there's something that they call rock fever. You get tired. I mean, you can only go so far, y'all. I mean, you know, and you can only do so many things. And a lot of people, they develop what's called rock fever. They just want off that island. Well, we drank this mushroom tea, and I got rock fever. And all that I remember about that was flying off of the island. I remember I asked the airline attendant when I got on the plane which side was going to turn up and face the island because I wanted to see it when I left. And she told me the wrong side. So when we took off, I just got up, undid my seatbelt, walked to the other side to an empty seat, and they were screaming at me. The next thing I remember, I woke up, and there was these people selling flowers. And I asked one of them where I was, and she said I was at LAX International Airport. So they were Moonies, and they were selling flowers is what it ended up being. So I called my boss and told him that I got rock fever and left the island. I didn't tell him I was doing mushroom tea. But I ended up going home, and I met this girl there, and her and I went to California in 1980. She ended up becoming the mother of my son. In 1982, I'd been in the car business out there, and I did really well. We were building our first home, and her and I both, I met this girl in Mobile, I'm going to tell you. I was selling speed when I met her, and man, it was instant love. This girl liked to drink like I did. She liked to party like I did. We just was a match, you know. And we ended up going to California, and she got pregnant in 82. And, you know, I decided that I didn't want my son, you know, to be raised by a drug addict. I mean, her and I were doing cocaine all the time. And so we decided that what we would do, and this was my first geographical change to not use. We decided that we would move up to up on the high desert up there to Apple Valley, and that's where that we built our home up by Hesperia, actually. And what happened was is that we did pretty good for a couple of weeks, and then we got that great addict thought that, you know, we'll just use on the weekends. We'll be able to control it this time. And I can tell you this, that within about 8 months, we had lost that home already. It wasn't long after that that we came back to Birmingham for our big geographical change. We weren't here very long, and she left, and she took my son. I ended up getting my son in about 6 to 8 months after that. I raised him for the next 5 or 6 years. And when I did that, I did real well. I did that addict quit. I didn't do no cocaine, but, you know, I would smoke pot. I never let my son see me smoke pot. I never drank and drove with him in the car. I only partied when I didn't have him or, you know, if my parents was watching, things like that. So I maintained for about right around 7 years. And he ended up going back to live with his mother. And when he did that, party was on. As a matter of fact, I ended up going back to California. And when I got back out to California this time, they had a new drug out there. And I liked it a lot better than I liked cocaine. It was called Crystal. And everybody was doing it. It was the shit. And so I was in the car business, and I was a general manager for a car dealership. And I dealt with bankers and influential people on a day-to-day basis, as well as my dealer principal. And, you know, I had a program down that worked for a long time. I would eat breakfast every morning. I would do a line, and then I would do another line at about 3 in the afternoon. I would do one when I got off of work at about 7. And I'd go home, and I was asleep by 2 a.m., 1, 2 a.m. I'd get up the next morning, eat breakfast, and this went on for about right around 7 years. Then I met this girl one night, and she taught me how to smoke it. About 8-9 months after learning how to smoke it, I had lost that job, and everybody knew, you know. My life was a wreck, and I ended up coming into some money. I'd been working out there for a long time and had made some money and came into some money, and I moved to Florida, and I had a big, nice house. I had a big, nice boat. I had cars. I had everything in the world going for me, and I'd always made good money. And I, you know, that pride in ego, I used to tell people, you know, it's unheard of for an 8th grade educated Alabama boy to make $100,000 a year, you know. And I thought that was really me. I was something special, you know. You see, from that time that I know now is that when I was 11 years old and then I found this new way to live, I fell completely out of the sunlight of the Spirit. You know, God was nowhere in my life except for the times that I got arrested or that I couldn't pay bills or something wasn't going right in my life. You know, I did them prayers then. God help me. You know, and when He didn't help me, fucker, you know, I mean, that's the way it was. And I ended up going to, I'd smoke crack, I'd smoke Freebase when I was in California, you know. I didn't like it that well because I didn't like the feeling after that I got through. And but I was in Florida and I'd met this beautiful young girl. She wasn't one of us. She was 20 years younger than me. This girl loved me to death. We were married for 8 years. I taught her how to be one of us. I taught her how to drink. She didn't even like drinking. She used to drink a half a wine cooler and would be blitzed and didn't like the feeling. But after being with me for 8 years, she learned how to like the feeling. And I introduced her. I had a business going in Atlanta, and I introduced her to crystal meth. And she liked that a lot. And, you know, I started really doing it wrong because I would stay at my office and she would get dressed and get ready for us to go out to dinner and things like that. And, you know, she'd call me and say, "Where are you?" at 10 o'clock and then at 11 o'clock and then at 1 o'clock. She'd be knocking on my office window and I'd be in there geeking on the computer. And she'd be like, "What's up?" Well, she ended up meeting a couple of girlfriends, and they smoked crack, and she started smoking crack, and that was unacceptable to a speed addict like me. I didn't like crack smokers, you know, and I ended up divorcing her, and I owe her an amends if I can ever find her, but I've prayed about it, and God will put that in my life when it's time. Tried to find her on the internet and some other things, and it didn't happen, so I've learned in this program to let it go and let God orchestrate that. If it's meant to be, then it's meant to be. But I owe her a big amends, you know, and I'm willing to do that amends. But I lost my business in Atlanta, and I ended up going to stay with my son. Now, when I started this business, my son, he started in this business with me, and that son that I never wanted to know or never wanted to be raised by a drug addict, it ended up, I knew that he'd been smoking some pot, and he was overweight, and he met some friends of mine, and he ended up doing speed with them, and so then I started using with him too. And My son watched what was going on in my life, and also he had a couple of major consequences that happened, or actually one major consequence that happened. And he seemed real quick that wasn't the life that he wanted to live. And he got the hell away from me. And that was the best thing he ever did. When did I lost that business in Atlanta, I called him and I asked him for help. And he says, "Yeah, Dad, you can come stay with me and I'll help you." At the time, he was the youngest store manager in the United States for Rent-A-Center out of over 3,000 stores. And he was only 23 years old. I went and stayed with him for a while, and he lives in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And I had went back to California, and actually I called him from California, and I came in from Fresno, California to Pascagoula, Mississippi 10 days before Katrina hit. When Katrina hit, I went and started working at a church, giving out food, and man, I watched what God did. God showed me just how all the things that I take for granted, you know, such as when we go to get a drink of water, you know, you think when you turn the faucet on, water's coming out, right? Well, I got to learn just how a privilege that having water is, you know? I mean, because there wasn't any. You know, and people came together there. You know, I love this book. It talks about that we're like passengers of a great liner after crash or whatever, that we come together, you know. But, you know, my experience in Pascagoula is just the way that the book explains it, because it says passengers of a great liner after the sinks or rescue, that they go their own ways. And that's what happened. You know, I got relocated back to Atlanta, and I'd been over there, and I ended up coming into some money again. I had 36 grand in the bank, and I thought it would be a real good idea to stop in and see this couple that I'd known, and see how they were doing, and just, well, know how I was doing. Because, see, at that time, I was testifying at street corners how good God was. I mean, man, I had this Katrina revelation, and God was great, and He had saved me, and it was all good. And man, I was going to church, and I was just on fire. So I thought I'd stop and let them know how good everything was going. And, in my attic thinking, y'all know, of course, that really wasn't why I stopped. I was looking for a party. I know that today in the back of my mind. All the rest of it was just the delusion or the lie that I was trying to tell myself, you know. And I stopped, and they happened to have a crack rock laying on the table, and I looked at it, and I said, "Can I hit that? I'll get some more." They were like, "That ain't what you thought it was." Because, see, they knew me from doing crystal meth, okay. I said, "Oh, I know what it is, because I'm a good addict. I know what all that shit is." I picked it up, and I hit it. And I can tell you this, that within 3 months later, the 36 grand was gone. I had been locked in my apartment. I didn't even go outside to check the mail. I had dealers that would deliver to me. You know, I looked in my dryer for people. My second sponsor I had in this program, he used to look behind refrigerators for people, and I looked in dryers for people. You know, I was convinced somebody was in my dryer. They were trying to get my dough. I lived in about $900 a month, 1,500 square foot, one bedroom bachelor's apartment in Atlanta. And I took a 16 penny nail and nailed my bedroom door too with it. And I would pull it out when I needed to go to the kitchen, you know. And sometimes I'd stay in the living room and nail it because I could watch people walking in there. I knew they were there. I mean, if y'all know what I mean, you know what I mean. All right. I didn't look through curtains. I put bedspreads over the curtains, comforters. They wouldn't see anything. They wasn't going to see my shit. Okay. I mean, it was bad, y'all. It was real bad. You know, I used to, I didn't party with guys. Y'all forgive me. I'm just going to tell you the truth, man. I didn't party with no hard tails. I had chicks all the time coming over to party. All right. And it got so bad at the end, I could be running flicks all day long and have naked chicks in the room, and all I'm worried about is how my Brillo's holding out. Okay, that's some insanity there. None of that shit mattered to me. All I wanted to know was that next hit was going to be good. That's all I cared about, you know? And It got really, 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 really bad. I ended up starting slinging dope because people liked what I was getting. Because when you spend that kind of money that quick, you meet a lot of people on the top. I'd met a connection that was bringing kilos out of New York, and shit was good, and he gave it to me right, and I was making money. Because, see, that's something I'd learned to do way back with lids of weed. So I always knew how to do that. And I always knew how to sling some dope and make some money. Get mine free anyway. And I lost that apartment. I ended up taking this lady hostage. She had a nice townhouse, and she bought me food. She could buy me an 8-ball every day, and I could use her car. And I had a place. That was some good moves right there. This went on for about 10 and a half months. And I ended up deciding that I had to do something because I knew I didn't care if I died. I was completely ashamed, and I wanted to change. I desperately did not want to smoke crack, and I was trying to quit. I mean, I would wake up every day saying I wasn't going to do it, you know, and then I was just going to do this, and that was going to be it. And the whole way I'd be going to get dope or having dope brought to me, I wasn't going to do that no more, you know. I mean, every day it was that way. But something inside of me, I was going to get high. I ended up coming back to Birmingham. I was going to get cleaned here. And my brother, I have a niece and nephew who's been crackheads for 20 years, and they've stole stuff from the family and things like that. And I hadn't lived here in 30 years. I haven't lived around my family. But when I told my brother what was going on with me, he couldn't let me in. You know, I mean, he has a family, you know. And so I ended up going and staying with a cousin. And I'd been okay. I hadn't done any dope in a few weeks. And my cousin smokes pot. And he wanted me to smoke some weed. I mean, just kept on at me about it. Clean you out, man. You know, this is all right. You know, and I took a few hits of weed with him one evening. And about 3 days later, I found me a crack house in Leeds. And I had a little meat truck, and I sold meat, and I did okay. I made money. And so anyway, well, as a matter of fact, I didn't have my truck then. I was using a different renting a vehicle. But anyhow, I did have my truck. Never mind. Anyway, yeah, I had my truck. Long lasting effects, y'all. Takes a while to get better, you know. Anyway, I found this place, and I was making money every day. So I had my own room in this crack house in Leeds. And thank God, I ended up getting arrested February 23rd. Well, actually, I got arrested February 22nd, 2007. And you know, I would have never thought in a million years of my life that I would say, thank God I got arrested. But you know, there at the end, I didn't care about anything anymore. I was completely, emotionally, spiritually, and financially, I was bankrupt. I mean, I was hustling every little bit of meat I could, whatever I could do just to get money to go buy another hit. I didn't care about living anymore because here was my dad. He's in an assisted living place, and instead of me going and spending time with him, I'm out getting high. And he was ashamed. I mean, he was ashamed of me. I mean, look who I was. I was a crackhead, y'all. My son, God bless him. You know, I was ashamed of being his dad. And I was sure that he was ashamed to have a crackhead dad for a crackhead for a dad. And I got arrested. And, you know, when I was smoking crack, I told y'all that I'd been testifying at street corners. And I can remember, you know, I wasn't only smoking crack. I mean, I was shooting coke, you know, everything. And I can remember asking God, how could you do this to me? I was walking hand in hand with you, and you let Satan reach up and pull me to hell. You know, that's how I felt. How did you do this to me? You know, thank God for this program and good sponsorship, because the sponsor pointed out to me that this book right here says that God didn't do that to me. That was my choice. You know, when I was in jail, I started praying, and I had a little Bible, and I had a moment of clarity after being in there for about a week or so. You see, I also had a lot of resentment, because I hadn't asked my family for nothing, and I was down there, and ain't nobody coming to get me out. You know, I kept looking out the window, man. I had a top cell. I was in D block, 12 cell, 6th floor. And I had the top cell and I could look out the window. I used to sit there and look out the window. Those guys in there was telling me, dude, that's going to run you crazy. You know, I kept thinking somebody was going to come get me out. I had a lot of resentment. I met a guy in there. He told me, he says, Eddie, he says, man, he says, you need to pray for blessings on your family because this is killing you, man. You know, he says, you need to pray that they're blessed with everything that they need. He says, it'll help you. I was like, are you crazy? That made no sense to me, dude. I mean, somebody doing me wrong, they even bought me a toothbrush. Somebody doing me wrong like that, all I'm going to pray for is a freight train to hit their ass. You know, a tornado to take their house. I'm not praying anything good for them, you know. But I did what that man told me to do. And sure enough, I started, something came over me and I could see that, you know, they were leaving me there because they couldn't let me come stay with them. And that was part of Tasca's deal, is that I had to have a place to go, you know. And they were just trying to help me in their own way. And I wasn't their responsibility anyway. And these things started coming over me while I was in jail. And I did. I got better with it. I got to where I was okay. And I started praying. And something profound happened to me when I was in jail. I did hear a silent, still voice that told me that I had gave myself to him when I was little. This is just my belief, y'all. This book teaches you that you can have any belief of God that you want. But he told me that I was his, and he was there to save me. And I had a sense of peace from that time. I got released after 30 days. They sent me to a recovery house, a halfway house. And, you know, in this program, you'll hear a lot of times, and then it got worse. Well, when I got out of jail, they sent me to a recovery house that's at 500 block West End. Any of y'all familiar with Birmingham? You know where Princeton Hospital is? You know where the bottom is? Well, this recovery house that they sent me to, there was people slinging crack on the corner every day. All right? And when I got, and it was me, I was the only white guy in the house. It was me and 7 black guys there. And when I got there, I went in, and this man, this reason when you read Reaching Out, or I read it, it means so much to me. This man had this recovery house that had 15 years clean, and he's never relapsed. And when I got there and I walked in that house, he looked at me and he says, Eddie, he says, is using dope the only problem you got? And I said, yeah. I said, it really is. I said, you know, and I've been praying about it, and I think I'm going to be okay right, you know. He says, really? I said, yep. He says, well, you seem pretty smart then. You mean dope's the only problem you got? And I said, well, yeah. And I started giving him my resume about how great I was, about the houses I'd owned and the businesses I'd owned and just how wonderful I was. He looked right at me and he says, Eddie, he says, you're so intelligent. You're 47 years old and you're living in a halfway house at 500 block West End with 7 other men. And you're going to be home by 11 o'clock at night. You got a curfew. How old was you when you had a curfew last? And if you ain't here and you don't go to 3 meetings in this house a week, you going back to jail. That's how intelligent you are. He says, I suggest you take a look at a blue book in there and start reading it. You might find out you got some other problems other than just using dope. He says, you might find out that dope ain't even your problem. Living is. I did not like this son of a gun at all. I mean, I did not like this man. Who the hell was he to talk to me like that? He didn't know me. I had a 3-car garage in Florida that was bigger than this house. He does not know who he was talking about. I was getting out of there as soon as I could. I knew that. I went in there and I started going to a couple of them house meetings. And I did pick up that book and start reading it. But also what I did is I started looking for me a place to live. Because see, my understanding was this. Or the way that I heard the judge was like this. That I didn't have no place to live. So once that I got out, if I got me a place to live, I could move. Okay? Well, I got out on a Friday. On Monday, I found a job. Tuesday, I started working. And I was making money. And about a week and a half, I went down to Warrior River, and I found me this nice little cabin right on the river. And I rented it. So I went back, and I called Task, and I went up. My caseworker wasn't there, and I talked to the supervisor. I told her I'd rented me a cabin down on the river, and that, you know, and I just wanted to let them know that I was moving out, da-da-da. And she didn't tell me anything that I couldn't move. And I went back to the recovery house. I didn't have no car at the time. And the person that was driving the company truck took me back there. And I loaded all my stuff up, you know, and I'm getting out, you know. And he comes there and he gets on the phone and he calls. And lady from CAS says, "You can't leave that house. That man's on your bond." I had to stay there for another 2.5 months. And that was the first, that was really God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because you see, that was about the middle of March and summer was coming. And you know, if I'd have left that recovery house without any recovery, it would have just been one more veil attempt. You know, I'd have been high today. I believe that with all my heart. And after reading that book, I found that I had these character defects. And I went and I asked that man, I said, "Look, I said, will you help me? I said, I found this book, I've got these character defects, and I see what you're talking about, and will you help me?" And he said, "Yeah, Eddie, I'll help you." This man had 15 years clean, and he was out there still helping people like us. Man, that means something to me today. I'll never forget that man. And that man was the first man that told me the truth about me. That's why I didn't like him. He told me the truth about me. My ego was smashed that day when that man told me how intelligent I was. Oh, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. Okay. But anyway, he told me the truth about me. And I stayed there for 2.5 more months, and then I was released, and I did get to go live at the little cabin on the river. By that time, I'd started going over to the hut. I'd fell in love with CA. And this sponsor, I'd worked up to my 4-step. I could never get with this sponsor, and then I got another sponsor over there. And, you know, that man helped me so much because he got me involved in these steps. And I was willing, you know. I was willing. You know, there's a guy that has 20 years in this, well, 21 now, and I really respect his recovery. And he helps a lot of men. And I had the pleasure for God to open the door for me to work for him for about 10 months. He owns a recovery house in Bessemer. And you know, that man, he said something one day in a meeting that hit my heart because he told my story when he said this. He said when he got here that he just bought into this thing 110%. And you know, that's my experience. My way of living was not working. And when I found CA and started going to the meetings and working the steps with a sponsor, and I seen that I could have a new way to live, I bought into it 110%. And I haven't looked back. I do this shit today just the same way that I did when I got there. You know? And I'm just going to touch a little bit now on things I learned about myself. First, when I got here, I was taught that I was selfish, self-centered. That I think that the root of my troubles today is that I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And I used to be pissed off at everybody else in the world, but today this program taught me that I stepped on their toes. That's why they retaliated at me. You know, because they didn't do the way I thought they should do. I treated them like crap. Or I tried to manipulate them. Or I tried to get over on them. You know, and I always had to make you think that I was something that I wasn't, because I was never comfortable in my skin. I wanted to be accepted. I wanted y'all to like me, or if you owed me money, or if I wanted something out of you, I wanted you to fear me. I had to do whatever I had to do, but I needed my way. You know, when I was at that recovery house, I called my son, and I told him I just got out of jail. And he says, "Yeah, Dad, I know." He says, "I came up to Birmingham, and Uncle Joe and them told me that you know, that you couldn't get out." And he says, "I'm mad at Uncle Joe," he says, "because Dad," he says, "he told me that," and y'all remember, I raised my son. Well, he lived with me for those years, and then he came back with me when he was 13 and stayed with me until he was 21 when he got away from me. And he told me, he says, Dad, he says, Uncle Joe told me that you're going to die a crackhead. And you're going to die an addict. And he says, Dad, he says, that really hurt me. And he says, if you do anything in the world for me, Dad, he said, please don't go out like that. He said, please don't go out like that. He says, I believe in you, Dad. He says, I've watched you come back from everything and always win. He said, but please don't die a drug addict. Don't die like that. And I started crying. And I went inside and I hit my knees right there and then. And I asked God, help me, God. I can't do this by myself. And, you know, like I said, I stayed in that crack house for 2.5 months and, well, almost 3 months. And they sold crack every day. And God never found it necessary for a crackhead like me to go out there and get any. That's a miracle right there in itself. You know, because I'm a drug addict. There's going to come a point in time I want to get high. But God kept that, and He protected me. You know, somebody came up to me and talked about what I shared the other night in a meeting. And it's, I like to do this a lot because, you know, when I first read this book, and I hope that some of this is going to help somebody in here. You know, when I was first given this book by my sponsor, and he told me to read the first 164 pages, you know, I'm going to tell you the truth. When I read Bill's story, what the hell does that have to do with me not smoking crack? This is some alcoholic 70 years ago. It made no sense to me. Okay? But today, I can relate to his story on every page. Every page. Because you see, today I'm looking for the similarities and not the differences. You know? I really relate to Bill. You know, Bill says, this was Bill's first step. He says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found that bitter morass of self-pity, quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Crack was my master. I can relate to that, y'all. You know, that was my first step. It was, and I couldn't stop. You know, and then Bill's second step. He said that, now, this wasn't really my second step because I had a conception of God, you know. Like I told y'all, in all the things and all my success, no credit had ever been given to God. All right? I would have told you years ago, real fast like, God ain't going to make sure you got no place to live. You got to do that. Alright? God can't do this and God can't do that. I have to do that. He gave me brains to do that. See, I thought that everything I did was because Eddie did that. I was the one that was wonderful. I was the one that was great. You know, this program has taught me that if I move out of the way and believe that my higher power, that all things are possible. You know, since I've been in recovery, I haven't went without a place to live. I haven't went without food. Life has been really good. And the more I move out of the way and the more that I give God credit, the better things get. And that's just my experience. But this is where Bill did his second step. And this is for people that may have a problem with God. You see, Bill had had a problem with God. He had had the religious type of God that he had heard his grandfather and he just didn't know about that. Now, he believed in a creator of the universe. And this is when the Abby Thatcher came to him and told him, basically, this suggestion that changed Bill's life. My friend suggested what seemed to be a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain and whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight of the Spirit at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe, and please hear this if you're having a problem with God or a higher power. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. My third step, I can totally relate to Bill. Then I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood Him to do with me as He would. I placed myself unreservedly under His care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without Him I was lost. I was ruthlessly faced with my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a hit of crack since then. And that's the fourth step, the fifth step. The fourth step, I wrote down all the shit I'd done and all the resentments I had against institutions, people, everything. I came up with my deep, darkest secrets that I was going to carry to my grave. There ain't no way I was telling nobody. If you found out, I'd lie to you and tell you it wasn't true. I was told I needed to share that, though, to another man. Openly didn't say it. And there was so much freedom that came from that, you know. Somebody shared in a meeting the other night something that really hit me. You know, they said that, or no, a speaker said this last night. He says, you know, a lot of people fear that fourth step. But yet the step says that we fearlessly made a moral inventory of ourselves. That means I'm not supposed to fear it. I'm supposed to be fearless. Because this is stuff I've already done, and now I'm ready to give it to God and get rid of it. To share it with another person. To get rid of it. You know? And when I did that, I'm going to tell you this. There was so much freedom from finally being exposed and the truth being out. It was amazing. Okay? The sixth and seventh step, that's where I looked for the defects of character that kept me messed up for so many years. You know, and I identify them defects of character. And I'm going to tell you, I can't get rid of them myself. I had to ask God to remove them. And I have to continuously work on them. And I have to realize that, you know, if one of those defects of character is that I'm a thief, that I can't ask God to remove that defect of character and keep stealing your shit and helping you look for it. God can't take away me smoking dope if I'm going to keep smoking dope, you know. I have to bring the shovel. I have to be willing to change. And the minute that I was willing to change and ask God to remove these defects of character and humbly ask Him to remove my shortcomings and ask Him to mold me the type of person He would have me to be, that today I want to live in His will. You see, this book tells me I come in here, the reason I'm here is because I have a lack of power. I can't quit using dope. I can't quit drinking alcohol. I can't quit living the way that I was living. I had to act out with women. I had to act out with everything in my life, and I had to have it all. And I couldn't change that. I had a lack of power. Self-will. Self-will failed miserably for me. I don't know about y'all, but it might be evident if we're here today. Self-will failed me miserably. And I had to find a power that could change my life. That power, this book suggests, is that I find a higher power greater than myself. For a lot of people, at first, it's a meeting. It's the sponsors. Because, see, that's a group of people that ain't using dope, so they're more powerful than me. Me alone, I'm using dope. If that's your higher power to begin with, that's all it takes. Okay? But put something in something to where, because If you keep doing the same thing you've been doing, you're going to keep doing the same thing you've been doing. If you want to change, you know, I don't have any friends that I had when I got here. I have friends now that my phone is full, y'all. Man, recovery is awesome. I'm going to tell you, recovery is awesome and it's happening worldwide. There's millions of people every day that are recovering from a hopeless state of mind. I stand before you today a recovered drug addict. God has restored me to sanity. And I have a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual maintenance that I continue to have every day. That's a miracle for a dope addict like me that had gave up on life and didn't care about living. You know? And it's a bail to any of us. As a matter of fact, Bill goes on to say that God doesn't make it too hard of terms for those who will seek Him. It means all you got to do is believe just a little bit. He'll open the door to make you believe a whole lot. Oh, that's my experience. You know, I'm going to go to one other thing, and then I'm going to close here in just a second. But I just want to tell you one other thing about this book that is so cool for me. Anyway, I didn't have it highlighted. Yeah, I did. Okay. All right. I've been speaking to you of a serious and sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with dope and alcohol in the worst aspect, but we aren't a gone lot. If newcomers could see no joy in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We try not indulge in cynicism over the state of nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulder. When a man see a man sinking into the mire of that of drugs and alcohol, we give him first aid and place what we have at our disposal for his sake. We do not recount and almost relive the horrors of our past, but those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over our seemingly tragic experiences out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others. That's strong. That's real strong. I've had so much fun, y'all, in recovery. It's amazing. We go on camping trips. You know, it's just so much laughter and fun. Recovery's cool, y'all, and it's happening worldwide. Once you get out of here, if you'll go to meetings, don't go back to hang out with your old friends, please, for God's sakes. If you think you're going to change them, you're wrong. They're going to take you back out before you bring them in. My suggestion to you, and it's only a suggestion, you have free will, you can do whatever you want. You can go get high when you get out of here. As a matter of fact, there's some people probably sitting in this room that's going to do just exactly that. I hate to tell you, but is this the truth? There's somebody in this room that's probably going to die from this disease. And that's just the truth too. There's a few people in this room, though, hopefully, that's going to take this seriously. Because this disease wants to kill you. It wants to kill me. It tries to come at me still. After a few days, after a few 24 hours, after a few years clean, it still comes at me. It wants to kill me. It's a serious disease. It's killing people every day. You know, it's the only disease in the world that tells you that you don't got a disease. That you aight.
It's aight. I got this under control, man.
I remember saying that. And the whole time, I was dying. If y'all know what I'm talking about, or if you can just get a glimpse of it, it may help you. If when you get out of here, if you'll go to meetings, find a whole new valley of friends that want what you want to stay clean, that want to be free. Start hanging out with winners in these programs. So get a sponsor. Start working the steps. And I promise you right now, if you do these things every day, you'll recover. And your life will be, my life is beyond my wildest dreams, you know. I found a fellowship that has grown up about me that is amazing. My life today, even though I walk through things, y'all, my life ain't perfect. But, you know, today I have a design for living that was given to me out of this book and this program. That I can get to the other side of stuff without having to get high, without having to use dope. You know, I don't know what God has in store for me. I'm quite sure that He's not done with me yet. And I don't know what his next things is for me to do. But I do know that, that just like Dr. Bob said it, and I'm going to read this and then I'm going to shut up. I just got to find it here. Old book so torn up. It's been read so much. This is why I'm here today. And this is why I continue to do this. This is Dr. Bob's, the last part of Dr. Bob. And it says, "It is the most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted." Man. My health is good, and I have regained my self-respect and the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal, and my business is as good as I can expect in these uncertain times. You know, my relationship with my son has been rebuilt. I experienced something in February that was amazing. I experienced being with my father when he passed away. I was able to be with him for the last 3 days of his life bedside with my son. And I held his hand. And I told my dad the first day while he was still coherent when I got there, I said, "Dad, I said, I've never told you this, but I said, I want you to know that I appreciate the sacrifices that you made to raise me, and I appreciate you being my father. And I just wanted to tell you that, Dad. I'm so thankful for you." And my dad, at 87 years old, looked up at me. And this is a man that was a veteran of 2 wars and 3 military branches. When he died, they had an American flag draped over his coffin. He was a man of men. He fought hand-to-hand combat in World War II in the infantry. And he looked up at me and he said, "Son," he said, "I admire you today." He said, "I admire your walk today." And I sat there and I held his hand when he died. And I kissed him on the forehead and told him goodbye. I was the only one there with him. And I was at total peace with my dad leaving this world because I knew that he was in a better place. And I let him know it was okay to go. My selfishness did not want me to stay, want him to stay. And that's what this program gave me, because y'all, a few years ago, I would have been in there cussing doctors and raising hell because how could they let my daddy die? You know? But this program taught me to be there for him and to be with him. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do so for 4 reasons. The sense of duty, it's a pleasure. Because in doing so, I'm paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. The 4th reason, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Thank y'all today for protecting me and keeping me clean one more day. Thank you for letting me tell you my story.